Good morning. I am finally calling to order the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. We'll begin by having the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katisa-Watoon, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Bonner. Representative Damon. Representative Heintzman.
I'm still here.
Representative Morrison.
Here.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Wasilek.
Present.
Representative West is excused.
So we do have a quorum, and that was what the delay was for. So my apologies to members of the public. We were waiting a quorum. So if I can have a motion to approve our minutes from the March 21st meeting of the division.
Believe it or not, Mr. Chair, I had time to review the minutes, and I would do that.
Okay, that's good. You had even more time than might have thought. So Representative Heintzman moves approval of the March 21st minutes. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of approval, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Representative Heintzman's motion passes. And so, members, our first bill today is House File 1653. And Representative Hassan, you can head on up, if you don't mind. And members, we heard House File 1653 in a previous meeting. If I can have a motion to put it, bring it before us.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Wasilek moves House File 1653 for referral to the Health and Human Services Finance Division. And members, this bill had been laid over for possible inclusion in our division reports, which are coming up as our next item of the agenda. But in putting together the reports, we realized that the North Star Care for Children account really is in the custody and the jurisdiction of the HHS Finance Division. And so the plan would be to simply move this bill to that division for its consideration. So we did have a discussion on the bill. I remember Representative Hassan had at least one, maybe even a couple testifiers, from what I recall, had a great presentation on that. Are there any, and so we had testimony, public testimony at that time, any questions that members have regarding House File 1653? And hearing and seeing none, then in that case, Representative Hassan, we will still give you a chance to give a final word on your bill before it leaves our committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I apologize for being late.
And it was not you, Representative Hassan, actually. We were not waiting for you.
I was halfway there, and then the chair said, "Are you coming?" And I'm like, I could go back. House File 1653 is about the North Care foster care can adoptees, children who are under 6 years old who are in foster care who are getting adopted. And as we know, children do not go into foster care because they have a great life. They go into foster care because they have the adults in their lives are not making the right decisions, and they have challenges. They have sometimes emotional issues. They have fiscal health issues. And cutting the reimbursement rate in half isn't fair for those children, and it's not fair for the people that have to adopt with children who have multiple health issues, emotional issues, behavioral issues sometimes. So that's the reason why House File 1653 is in front of the committee, and I ask for your support.
Thank you very much, Representative Hassan. And with that, Representative Wasilek renews her motion that House File 1653 be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Representative Hassan, you and your bill are on your way to HHS Finance. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, for stopping by.
Thank you.
Okay, so members, we are now turning to our two division reports. And so here's the process. We're going to be hearing I'll be moving the two bills and then moving the delete all amendments to the bills to put them in the shape of our division reports, at least as proposed. We're going to receive a walkthrough of the bills this morning from House Research. We actually have some special guests. I feel like this is like the special season finale episode of Early Childhood, where our special guests come back and join us. And then we'll be receiving public testimony tonight on the bills, and we'll do those together and receive that tonight. And then on Thursday then members can submit any amendments they have by the usual deadline of 3 p.m. on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, we'll be marking up the bills, walking through each in turn and discussing amendments, voting on amendments, if there are any, and then discussing the bills and voting on the bills. Any questions that folks have regarding that process first, just to make sure we'll get, and we can obviously obviously there'll be other questions along the way, but before we begin, we just want to see. So hearing none, what I think I'm actually going to do is take House File 2610 first and just make that go in that order. And I'm just going to do this from this chair. So I'm moving House File 2610, put it before the committee. And then in addition, I am moving the DE3 amendment to put the bill in the form that I wish for discussion as our Education Finance Division report, or Education Division report. And so what I guess I would ask is for approval of the DE3 amendment. It'd simply be amending the bill, putting in the author's form, and then again we'll get a walkthrough of that DE3 amendment, testimony tonight, and then the amendments on Thursday. So any discussion on that author's amendment, DE3 at the moment? And then hearing none, all in favor of approval to put the bill in the form that I wish with adoption of the DE3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. So House File 2610 now has the DE3 amendment attached to it. It's been amended in that way. And so what I'd ask is for our House research staff to walk through the amended House File 2610 and so members can understand what is in it. And that really, again, is the purpose for this morning. It's just for our understanding. And I also note, members, there is a concordance document that discusses where some of the provisions in the delete all come from some various bills. Okay. Please, Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, so I'll start with going briefly through the sections, and then Ms. Adrians from House Fiscal will touch a little bit more on the spreadsheet and the numbers, which is in the appropriation section, which is the last section in the delete all amendment. So moving through it, section one is a provision from Representative Richardson's House File 1785, and this would modify pupil dismissal requirements so that a child who's participating or enrolled in a pre-kindergarten program would not be able to be dismissed. Then section two establishes licensure requirements for those providing instruction to groups of children in various early education type programs. Section three is the first of a series of sections that were proposed in legislation in 2018. This section establishes that age-appropriate measures would need to be utilized in the VPK program. Section four is one of a number of Department of Education finance and policy proposals for this year, and this addresses fee setting when a child has mixed delivery, so services that's a combination of scholarship or VPK along with other services, and provides for clarification on when fees could be imposed. Section 5 is actually coming from a couple of different bills that have been heard by the committee. And the essence of this is to split the VPK grouping so that Minneapolis and St. Paul are separate groups. And then there's also a clarification around the allocations. Section 6, now I'm on page 6 of the delete all, also comes from a couple of bills that have been heard on in committee on VPK and School Readiness Plus and Department of Education proposals. And this establishes that the VPK and School Readiness Plus number of slots would continue at the level that it's set for fiscal year 18, instead of that slot number dropping down. It had been temporarily increased for 2 years and was set to return down to a lower level. Section 7 is the first of a series of sections on early learning scholarships, and this has a couple of pieces to it. One is to modify income verification requirements, and then the next piece is somewhat potentially a larger policy discussion or substantive change on page 7, at the top of page 7. This would modify early learning scholarship eligibility ages to go from birth to 3 for any new scholarship recipients. And in combination with the language at the top of 7, which is paragraph B, and in paragraph C on that same page, the effect would be that if any new recipient of an early learning scholarship would have to be from age birth to 3, but siblings could be a bit older, and anyone who had been receiving a scholarship either currently or in the future would be able to continue to receive one until being eligible for kindergarten. And then, Mr. Chair and members, Section 8, also on page 7, makes some a couple of modifications. One is on when developmental screenings are required for early learning scholarship recipients. It also eliminates a limitation on the pathway to number of slots that can be established. Section 9 removes some obsolete language. Section 10 is another proposal from the Department of Education. This would establish a new early learning scholarship account and provide for transfers and a statutory appropriation so that appropriations for early learning scholarships would shift over to this account in the Special Revenue Fund and would provide for ongoing use of those dollars rather than canceling back to the general fund. This also establishes a standard or a set amount of $950,000 annually for administrative costs of the department, which historically had been established in riders as part of the early learning scholarship appropriations. And then Section 11, and just sort of jumping back to the House files where this comes from, these last few sections have been kind of a combination. There are three different House files that have some parts of these various proposals, so sort of looping through House Files 2463, 1230, and 1590, essentially. Section 11 makes a conforming change on the calculation of pupil units for School Readiness Plus program, which would, in effect, continue under the bill. And then Sections 12 and 13 come from both Department of Education and a standalone bill from Representative Herr on allowing for background checks to be performed by the Department of Human Services for tribal organizations as well as Head Start programs. Section 14 is another conforming change on the pupil unit calculation. And then Section 15 is a modification from a proposal on early childhood education quality and coordination. A number of those provisions are not in the delete all. And this section modifies what had been originally proposed as a working group to instead be a legislative report that would direct the Commissioners of Education and Human Services to look at coordination between the child care assistance programs and early learning scholarship program. That report would be due February 15th, 2020. And then, Mr. Chair and members, Section 16 contains the appropriations. One thing of note, in general, both this delete all and the delete all for the HHS division report show appropriations that are reflective of changes from base. There is one exception to that, which is the early learning scholarships. The spreadsheet that Ms. Adrians will get to will show the change over base. The appropriations here, so that members are aware, is actually the full amount that would propose to be appropriated. So it's the change as well as the base coming in. And that is subdivision 2 on page 13, and it's the first of the appropriations. The other appropriations are coming from a proposal from Representative Richardson on providing funding for the Metro Deaf Charter School, in effect. This is a modification from the original proposal so that it would provide for grants of $100,000 each year in the biennium and ongoing. Subdivision 4 is an appropriation for Reach Out and Read Minnesota. This is a a proposal from House File 2111 from Representative Katiza Watun, and then Subdivision 5 contains appropriations for a college savings account program in St. Paul. This is a proposal from Representative Herr.
Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. If you will look at, there's a one-page tracking sheet in your packets or on top of your packets. And what this does is just shows the cost of all of the provisions in the Delete All Amendment. These are all the pieces that will roll up into the Education Finance Committee and end up in that tracking sheet. So I just pulled out just the line items for the changes, as Mr. Burris said. So on the very top line, line 11, it shows general education and other programs. The voluntary pre-K piece that maintains the existing slots that were distributed in for fiscal 2019, this is the total cost of making that change. For voluntary pre-K, the funding gets distributed among several different programs. And so the total cost in the first biennium of doing this provision is just over $47 million. And if you'll notice the table that's below this top table where it starts with line 31, this shows how that $47 million is distributed through different programs in the education finance budget. And then the other early education provisions, so these are in the top table starting on line 14. So the college savings account program, this is $250,000 in 2020 and 2021 only. It's not ongoing in the tails. The early learning scholarships, as Mr. Burris said, the base for this program is about $70 million per year, and what this line shows is just the additional funding that this Delete All bill proposes. It's $6 million in each year for the current biennium, and then in the tails for fiscal year 22 and 23, it's $2.725 million each year ongoing. And this will be a transfer to a special revenue fund, as Mr. Burris noted. On line 17, the Metro Deaf Charter School receives a grant for $100,000 each year to fund some of the younger ages. On line 18, this is the writer for Reach Out and Read Minnesota. The amount is $105,000 in 20 and $100,000 in 2021, and it is only in the first biennium. This is not an ongoing into the tails program. And that's all, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Adrians. And so a reminder to members that we'll have plenty of time to debate and discuss, et cetera, on Thursday. But are there questions for House Research about the just about the content of the bill? And so not seeing any for now. So then in that case, I will lay over House File 2610 in anticipation of public testimony tonight on that bill. And then with that, we'll move to the other bill, which is House File 1801. So I will move House File 1801 before the committee. And I'm offering the DE6 amendment. And again, this is to put the bill in the form of our division report. And then again, we'll have plenty of time to walk through the bill and testimony, et cetera. Pardon me, Representative Heintzman, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Just a clarification. I've heard you say twice that we'll be tonight having public testimony, and there'll be, I'm assuming, some time for questions during that period. Just wanted to confirm that if you members had questions relative to the bill, you're not going to be looking for those questions now. That would be coming later tonight as well.
So, Representative Heintzman, so I'd say questions regarding the couple different pieces here. So questions regarding just understanding the content of the bill, now would be the right time to ask those. We'll certainly be able to ask those as well on Thursday. We'll have House Research, so we may not have every one of the experts who are sitting here. I suppose that we can presumably reach on out if necessary. But if there are questions you have about the content of the bill, just sort of what's in it and understanding it, this would be the good time for that. There'll be testimony tonight. I would not anticipate questions of testifiers because this is simply the public providing input and thoughts about about any aspect of the bill. And then on Thursday, so if you're talking about questions to me as the author as to why, you know, to justify why something was included or not, et cetera, that would be, we'll have time for that on Thursday then, in connection first with amendments, but then also with the final vote on the bill. So, is that a follow-up question that you may have?
That helps, Mr. Chair. But just to be clear then tonight, if we did have questions for testifiers, would we be letting us ask those if they did come up?
Representative Heitzman, I guess if there's, so I will say that when I've participated in this in the past, I have not seen questions of testifiers. I mean, I think if there's, I think it, at this point, just with the nature of the bills, this is the chance of the public to provide thoughts and concerns, and then if there's a point that comes out of that, certainly that you can then bring that up on Thursday and certainly interact with an individual testifier. I guess I wouldn't totally rule it out if there's some clarification you'd be seeking based on something somebody would say. But in general, I think it's just for folks to provide and for the public to provide their input. But yeah, follow up, Representative Heisman.
That's really all I was concerned about to that second point, was if there was a clarification needed as a testifier may bring some kind of piece of information forward. I just want to make sure that we're still allowed to ask a question if necessary. So.
Yeah, and so I guess I would ask, that it be a clarifying question about something that may confuse you about something that's asked. I guess what I don't want to turn it into is often if we have a bill, you have testifiers, we end up getting into a back and forth, it's a debate about the bill, and we've got all of our time on Thursday morning and Thursday evening for that. And I suspect we'll have a bunch of testifiers. And so I don't want to get bogged down in that. So if it's something that is clarifying a question or a point that a testifier has made, then I'll allow that. But I think it gets beyond that. If it gets into opinion about the bill, argumentation about the bill, I'm going to ask members to please save that for Thursday, and then we'll have plenty of time for that. Hopefully that makes sense. But certainly if there's a clarification, somebody says something that confuses you, a comment somebody makes, certainly that's a chance to ask that. But in general, I think we want to keep that pretty limited tonight, just focus on receiving information from the public. So, thank you. Okay, so I had moved both House File 1801 and then the DE6. And again, this is to put the bill in the form that I wish, and so we can then get our House Research to walk us through. Any further discussion about the DE6? And then hearing none, all in favor of approval of the DE6 amendment to put in the form the author wishes, please say aye. Any opposed? Okay. So House File 1801 has been amended with the DE6 amendment. And now, again, I'll ask House Research, I think Mr. Burris, to walk us through the amended House File 1801. Or Mr. Berg, I guess, is going to start us off. Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair and members, in this case, since the appropriations start first, it's maybe most helpful to start with the spreadsheet.
Makes sense, please.
Members should have four pages, I think it's two actual sheets, that is labeled 2019 Session Early Childhood Finance HHS items that looks like this. Just to orient you to the way Human Services spreadsheets look, this has got at the top of the page summary of net expenditures in the bill for all agencies. If you'll look at line 6 and go over to the center of the columns under fiscal year 2020 and 2021, you'll see that the net general fund expenditure in this bill is $46 million. And then if you follow that line over to the very right-hand column, you'll see that the net general fund expenditure in the tails is $108.3 million. Going down, there's a section for each the Human Services Department and the Health Department that summarizes theirs. But I'll start with the individual items on line 135 of page 1. This is the same as the governor's items on Child Care Assistance Program federal compliance items. That is an $8.2 million expenditure from the general fund in 2021 and $21 million in the tails. Going to the very last line on the first page, item 143, this is the federal requirement to update our maximum rates. You see that in 2021 this cost $10.8 million and is $51 million in the tails. going to page 2 on line 167. This is the governor's child care assistance program integrity item. This will have an effect of saving $2.1 million in 2021 and $2.8 million in 2022 and 23. I will, when we get to the language, I think Mr. Burris will walk through, there are appropriations riders that outline, or I can't, that outline staffing changes that are come along with many of these in program integrity items. On line 189, this is the basic sliding fee waiting list item. It will, it is essentially the same as the governor's. The appropriation is just slightly smaller by about a little less than $400,000 in 2021 and $200,000 in the tails to accommodate a couple of other priorities that we'll come to in the bill. On line 194, this is the item that came up in the governor's supplemental budget for adding a staff person at the department to plan for the moving to electronic record keeping and electronic filing. That's $153,000 in 2021, one time. Moving to line 486, this is federal compliance in fees in the state government special revenue fund for license exempt centers. It has a savings of $131,000 to the general fund and $143,000 in the tails. That's largely due to the fact that the fees are being swapped from the general fund to the state government special revenue fund, creating a savings in the general fund. The last line on that, on page 2, line 494, is another item from the governor's supplemental budget involving fraud prevention in the CCAP program. That costs $2.1 million in 2021 and $2.4 million in 2022-23 from the general fund. Moving to page 3 on line 500, the fraud prevention investigations expansion item, this is the governor's revised budget item, which is now projected overall to save $204,000 from the general fund in 2020-2021. And $364,000 in the tails. I'll just pause on the detail there. When we get to the language, you'll see a lot of sections, appropriation sections, that don't necessarily relate to this committee. This item involves hiring a staffer at the central office and more grants out to the counties for fraud prevention across multiple public programs, not just child care. And so you'll see as you go down the list of detail under this that there is assumed to be savings in various programs outside of this committee's jurisdiction that are part of this item. Line 5.16 is the expansion of the CSRS and CCAP investigation expansion program, again, a governor's item. This will create a savings of $74,000 in the general fund in 2021. And $200,000 in the tails. The item on the bottom of the page 3, 522, is federal compliance relative to background checks. This involves the state being required to buy into some additional databases for background checks for CCAP. It has a cost of $281,000 in 2021 and $322,000 in the tails. And moving to the last page, on line 532 is the Head Start background studies item. This appeared in both the K-12 and the Human Services sections. It nets to zero, but there are some changes in the fees. Moving down to line 537, this is the first children's finance bill that we heard, House File 2420. It puts out a $1 million in 2020 and 2021 one time for loans under this program to child care providers, their business expansion and startup loans. On line 541 is the retain grants bill we heard, HF 2230. 64. It puts $100,000 a year out on a permanent basis for the retained grants program. And on line 545 is House File 2581, which provides $260,000 in 2020 to distribute diapers at food shelves in across the state. And then there's a no-cost item, which on 549, which is changes relative to the False Claims Act compliance. And then at the very bottom of the page, there is one item at the Health Department on line 630, which is a $500,000 increase on a one-time basis in fiscal year 2020 and 2021 to the Home Visiting State Expansion Program. And then again, Mr. Chair, on the front page on line 6, you see the net, which is a $46 million net expenditure in the general fund and 108.3 in the tails. And that's it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Berg. Before I turn to Mr. Burris, I just wanted to note that my packet at least had a an extra copy of the DE3 from House File 2610. Well, I just want to note, because in case there was any confusion, that it is the DE6 we're working off of, and that other DE3 was just a extra copy from the other bill. So we can just disregard that. We'd already dealt with that. So we'll turn to Mr. Burris to walk us through the bill, or and then his colleagues, I think, some guest stars here.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, I'll be starting with the H-1801 DE6 amendment. So this is the thick one. Article 1 contains the appropriations that Mr. Berg from House Fiscal had just walked through. So Section 1 sets up the appropriations structure. Section 2 then contains the appropriations to the Commissioner of Human Services, starting with a total. And then on page 2, subdivision 2 contains the various staffing proposals around program integrity that the Department of Human Services had proposed. So that is a series of riders on inspections, child care assistance programs, data analysts looking at fraud and abuse, the Office of Inspector General investigators, tracking system, fraud prevention investigation grant program, law enforcement contracting, as well as in the next subdivision, some other programmatic improvements. So then on page 4, there's a series of subdivisions that refer to some, that identify some of the savings that Mr. Berg had outlined as a result of fraud investigations and fraud, waste, and abuse related initiatives. So this is what the department is currently anticipating in savings across a variety of programs as a result. Also on page 4, subdivision 11, this expresses or establishes appropriations to reduce the waiting list in the basic sliding fee program, and it outlines the methods and prioritization for allocating those additional dollars. So again, this is a these are appropriation amounts over base. It's kind of expressing a change item. Subdivision 12 is at the bottom of page 5. That provides a total then with the substantive riders on page 6. These are a couple of the other appropriations that Mr. Burgett outlined. The first is the First Children's Finance. That's site assistance grants. The language underlying that is a little bit later in this article, and then retained grants appropriation is has statutory language that's in a later article, so we'll be sort of returning back to that. And then subdivision 13 contains the grants to food shelf programs for diaper purchases. Also on page 6 is the appropriation to the Commissioner of Health, and this is for home visiting programs, and that is associated with the new statutory provision that's also in a subsequent article. And then finally on page 7 in this article, this is the grant program language around the First Children's Finance grants. And with that, Mr. Chair, brings us to Article 2.
Okay. Ms. Pinelli?
Mr. Chair and members, Danielle Pinelli from the House Research Department. Article 2 is the early care finance and policy article. It begins on page 8 of the DE6. The first three sections of that article are all making changes to definitions under the statute that governs the child care assistance program. It adds a definition of homeless and then modifies definitions of provider and transition year families. Section 4 on page 9, this changes the frequency of the child care market rate surveys under the CCAP program, going from every 2 years to every 3 years beginning in 2021. Section 5 on page 9 modifies the application process for CCAP. It specifies a process that counties must use when handling applications of families who meet the definition of homeless. Section 6 on page 10 modifies the portability pool by requiring families who are receiving basic sliding fee child care assistance and move from one county to another to notify the family's previous county of residence of the move, and it also removes the 6-month time limit on receipt of portability pool assistance. Sections 7 and 8 provide continuity of care for kids who are aging out of child care assistance by allowing a family to remain eligible for CCAP until its next redetermination if a family has a child that reaches age 13 or age 15 if the child has a disability. Section 9 on page 13 of the DE requires the amount of child care authorized to continue at, Section 9 relates to assistance for families who are homeless. This makes homeless applicants for child care assistance eligible for 60 hours of child care assistance per service period for 3 months. Section 10 starts on page 13 and then goes over to page 14. This relates to the CCAP maximum rates, and this changes the maximum rates so that they're based on the 2018 Child Care Provider Survey. And then the change on page 14 to paragraph I changes the maximum registration fees that are paid and also bases it on the 2018 survey. Section 11 on page 15 begins a series of changes that run from section 11 through section 17 that are related to the fair hearings process under CCAP, modifies this process. So section 11 modifies the process by allowing an applicant or by stating that an applicant or recipient does not have a right to a fair hearing if a county agency or the commissioner takes action against the provider. Section 12 allows a provider to request a fair hearing only if a county agency or the commissioner has taken certain actions. Section 13 modifies the joint fair hearings process under CCAP. Section 14 on page 17 provides notice to providers. So before taking an action that's appealable, a county agency or the commissioner must mail a written notice to the provider against whom the action is being taken. Section 15 specifies the circumstances under which a provider's fair hearing must be stayed. Section 16 specifies the county agency's or the commissioner's action is considered final unless the commissioner receives a timely and proper request for an appeal. Section 17, which starts at the bottom of page 17, provides for administrative review. It specifies the conditions under which a provider has the right to an administrative review, specifies the timeline a county agency or the commissioner has for mailing a written notice to a provider when suspending payment or denying or revoking the provider's authorization, It specifies the duration of a payment suspension or the denial or revocation of a provider's authorization, and it lists conditions under which the commissioner may find that good cause exists not to deny, revoke, or suspend a provider's authorization. Section 18 is the retaining early educators through attaining incentives now, the retain grant program, and this is just establishing authority in statute for this program. Section 19 on page 20 is related to the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee. This section extends the advisory committee to June 30th of 2025, and it adds two members to the committee. Section 20, beginning on page 22, relates to home visiting for pregnant women and families with young children. This directs the Commissioner of Health to award grants to community health boards, nonprofit organizations, and tribal nations to start up or expand home visiting programs that serve pregnant women and families with young children. Section 21 on page 24 relates to appeal of department actions, and this specifies a child care provider's rights related to the department's action taken under the CCAP program fraud investigation statute. Section 22 relates to decertification of license exempt providers. It modifies the list of conditions under which the commissioner may decertify a center, and it specifies the process for a certification holder to request a reconsideration of a decertification. And then section 23 is a repealer, and that just repeals several statutes and rules related to the fair hearings process and sanctions.
Thank you, Ms. Pinelli. And are you continuing to the next article, or is it one of your colleagues?
Looks like. Mr. Chair, I believe Ms. Sunderman is going to be going over Article 3, and then I'll be back for Article 4.
Okay. We'll welcome you back. And Ms. Sunderman, once you settle in, you can please begin.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll be going over Article 3, which relates to child care licensing. Section 1 incorporates two of Representative Pryor's bills, House File 1925 and House File 2047, with some slight changes. This is starting on page 26 of the DE. In paragraph C, this is related to the exit interviews bill, and there's some modifications. So it prohibits the commissioner from issuing a correction order or other licensing action for violations of rule or law not discussed in an exit interview, except if the license holder chooses not to participate in an exit interview. And it requires the licensing agency to offer an alternate time for the exit interview in the event that the exit interview gets interrupted or the license holder can't complete it at the time of the inspection. Paragraph D on page 27 establishes a process for family child care license holders to dispute county licensor interpretations of a licensing requirement and allows them to request clarification from the Commissioner of Human Services and establishes the process around that. Section 2 at the bottom of page 27 is based on House File 1841 allowing for reusable water bottles in child care centers. It uses the language from the governor's budget bill instead of the language in House File 1841. Sections 3 and 4 are based on House File 740, Representative Quam's bill. Section 3, I believe, remains unchanged and requires the Department of Human Services rather than licensed child care providers to develop policies and procedures for reporting suspected child maltreatment and to provide the policies and procedures to the providers in plain language. Section 4 was in the original bill, House File 740 was repealed. This is instead modified to remove an obsolete date and remove the requirement for the licensing agency telephone number to be printed in bold and large font. And it also modifies the terminology to change it from informing parents who have concerns to informing parents who have questions. Section 5 is one of these sections from House File 1926, the Delete Everything Amendment, or the DE1, I believe. And this relates to the supervision of a child care license holder's own child. It allows an individual to supervise a family child care license holder's own child without meeting licensure requirements if the individual is related to the license holder, is not an employee of the program, and if the person only cares for the license holder's own child. Section 6 and also Sections 8 and 10 relate to the emergency planning federal compliance to include accommodations for infants and toddlers. And Section 6 is related to the Child Care Center Emergency Preparedness Plans. Section 7, also from House File 1926, exempts individuals caring only for the license holder's own child, so those individuals in Section 5, from any of the family child care training requirements. Section 8 from House File 1924, again, adds a requirement for accommodations for infants and toddlers in emergency preparedness plans, and this is for family child care plans. Section 9 is from House File 1926, the DE, and there are a few modifications, some sort of technical changes, but Subdivision 1 permits the use of a substitute caregiver for family child care for up to 400 hours, and I believe the previous version of this was 300 hours and requires the license holder to document the substitute care. Subdivision 2 relates to emergency replacements in family child care. So paragraph A allows for an emergency replacement who hasn't completed training or background study requirements to provide emergency care for children in an emergency situation. It also specifies what constitutes an emergency. Paragraph B requires the license holder to minimize the time an emergency replacement supervises children and specifies that the emergency supervision can't exceed 24 hours per incident. Paragraph C prohibits the license holder from knowingly using an emergency replacement who would be disqualified from providing care for children if a background study were conducted. Paragraph D requires the license holder to arrange for emergency care by a substitute caregiver rather than an emergency replacement, if possible. Paragraph E is a bit different from the last version of this. So this requires the license holder to notify the county licensing agency within 7 days that an emergency replacement was used, and then requires the county licensing agency to notify DHS within 3 business days of the license holder's use of an emergency replacement. And paragraph F specifies that the license holder is not required to provide names of substitutes or emergency replacements to parents or the county licensing agency in advance. And finally, Section 10 adds the requirement for the accommodation for infants and toddlers, and this is for certified license exempt child care center written emergency plans. And that concludes Article 3.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderman. It sounds like Ms. Pinelli's coming back up then for the next article, was my understanding. And so, Ms. Pinelli, feel free to begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to be going over Article 4, the Program Integrity Article, which is the final article of the bill. It begins on page 33 of the DE6. The language in this article comes entirely from House File 2319 as it was amended, I believe, in this committee last week. So I don't know how much detail you want me to go through this.
Maybe you can just give us the just the highlights by section at least. I know we did just here last week, but I also want to make sure that the folks are well oriented. Yes, maybe just at a high level at least. Thank you.
Sure, Mr. Chair. So section one amends a section on investigative data, allowing welfare data that is collected as part of an enforcement investigation to be disclosed to other agents within the welfare system or to other government investigators, unless the disclosure would compromise an ongoing DHS investigation. Section 2 relates to liability for certain acts. It modifies the penalty for fraud against the government under the False Claims Act. Section 3 relates to child care data. It defines child care assistance program data and classifies as private payment data that identifies an individual assistance recipient and specifies that payment data is public if it relates to payments made to a child care center under certain circumstances. Section 4 relates to the date of eligibility for assistance under CCAP, and it limits retroactive payments to 3 months from the date of application. Section 5 on page 37 modifies record-keeping requirements under the CCAP program. Section 6 on page 38 relates to provider payments under CCAP, and it requires providers to bill only for services that meet specified documentation requirements. And it expands the list of conditions under which the commissioner or county may refuse to issue a child care authorization to a provider or revoke an existing authorization or stop payment. Section 7 relates to absent days under CCAP. It defines absent day and holiday limit, and it requires providers to properly bill for these days. Section 8 relates to limits on receiving public funds. For providers who are excluded from a program administered by the Department of Human Services, it requires the commissioner to prohibit the excluded provider from receiving grant funds or registering in any other program administered by the commissioner. And it also requires the commissioner to disenroll, revoke, or suspend a license, disqualify, or debar the excluded provider, vendor, or individual in any other program administered by the commissioner, and it defines excluded and provider. Section 9 on page 42 modifies the definition of applicant under the chapter of statutes governing human services licensing. In fact, the next several sections are just modifying definitions or adding definitions under the chapter of statute that governs human services licensing. That goes through section 15 on page 43. Section 16 on page 44 modifies the list of entities that are prohibited from conducting certain actions without having a license under the human services licensing statutes. Section 17 makes conforming changes related to actions that may be taken against an unlicensed entity. Section 18, application for licensure. This makes conforming and other changes to licensure application requirements under the Human Services Licensing Chapter. That section goes on for 3 or 4 pages. Section 19 begins at the top of page 49, and that allows the commissioner to provide an electronic notification to a municipality or other political subdivision that's affected by a license issued under the human services licensing statutes. Section 20 modifies the list of items a licensing inspection must include. Section 21 on page 50 modifies the list of items the commissioner must evaluate before issuing, denying, suspending, revoking, or making a conditional license. Section 22 on page 51 specifies the commissioner must issue a license consistent with Human Services licensing application procedures or temporary change of ownership procedures, makes other technical and conforming changes. Section 23 on page 53 requires a license holder to notify the commissioner and obtain the commissioner's approval before making any change that would alter the information that's included on the license. And it lists other changes for which the license holder must notify the commissioner and specifies the documentation that a license holder must provide to the commissioner when a license holder changes information on file with the Secretary of State. Section 24 modifies the list of entities that must meet certain requirements when applying for a license to place children for adoption. Section 25, which begins at the bottom of page 54, relates to license applications after a change of ownership. It specifies that a license is not transferable or assignable and requires submission of a new license application if the commissioner determines that there has been a change in ownership, and it lists the process for that application and for granting a license. Section 26 begins on page 57, and that modifies the list of circumstances under which the commissioner may deny a license. Section 27 sets out requirements for the commissioner related to closing a license if the commissioner determines that a licensed program has been inactive for a consecutive period of 12 months or longer. Section 28 makes technical and conforming changes to a section related to sanctions and appeals. Section 29 relates to temporary immediate suspensions, and it modifies the list of circumstances under which the commissioner must act immediately to temporarily suspend a license. Section 30 relates to immediate suspension expedited hearings, and it sets the burden of proof in an expedited hearing as a preponderance of evidence for suspensions in cases where the license holder is criminally charged in state or federal court with an offense that involves fraud or theft against a program administered by the commissioner. Section 31 begins on page 62. That relates to license suspension, revocation, and fines, and it modifies the list of circumstances under which the commissioner may suspend or revoke a license or impose a fine. Section 32 begins on page 65. That's related to financial misconduct. It just modifies the definition of financial misconduct or misconduct under the statute that governs CCAP fraud investigations. Section 33 defines provider under the chapter of statute related to CCAP fraud investigations. Section 34 relates to administrative disqualifications under the chapter of statutes related to CCAP fraud investigations. It specifies the conditions under which the Department of Human Services must pursue an administrative disqualification, and it specifies the process for pursuing an administrative disqualification and what the provider repeal rights are when an administrative disqualification is pursued. Section 35 relates to hearing authority. It makes some technical changes. Section 36 is related to vendor of medical care under the medical assistance chapter of statutes, and it clarifies a definition. Section 37, beginning on page 67, relates to grounds for sanctions against vendors. It expands the list of reasons for which the commissioner may impose sanctions against a vendor of medical care. Section 38 on page 68 relates to sanctions under the medical assistance chapter of statutes.
Ms. Pennelly, I think that these few are related to medical assistance as opposed to early childhood programs. Maybe you could jump to the next. I think there's just a little bit left that's related to early childhood specifically.
Mr. Chair, I believe the next several sections all relate to medical assistance. I think we probably will jump to section 52 on page 79, which is the last section, and that establishes criminal penalties for acts involving human services programs.
Okay. I guess that's it. Thank you so much. And thanks to our amazing team of House Research staff walking through. Questions for House Research about the contents of the amended bill? I'm not seeing any questions that folks have. So the plan then is we'll be in recess in just a minute. We're going to come back at 6 p.m., I believe, is when we're scheduled. Room 400 North is what we're able to get. Crowded schedule here. For members of the public, we'll be looking to have testimony be limited to 2 minutes because we're expecting a number of testifiers. And so I will be strict with that and ask folks to please restrict their remarks to that. And we'll take public testimony and then again have on Thursday we'll be walking through the bill with any amendments and then discussion and then voting. So thank you. And with that, members, we are in recess, expected to come back at 6 p.m., but otherwise to the call of the chair. Thank you. We are back to order in the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division, and we are now taking public testimony on House Files 1801 and 2610. And so to confirm, the plan is to have 2 minutes per testifier. And testifying on either or both bills. And we have a number of folks who signed up in advance, and we'll reach out to others as well. The first person who is scheduled to testify is Valerie Dosland, and so if she can come up to the front, please. Dosland, I'm sorry, Valerie, I may be mispronouncing your last name. And so if you can please, once you settle in, and make sure, and everybody who testifies, please make sure you get that microphone right in front of your mouth so we get everything recorded. Thank you. And then please identify yourself for the record, and then please begin. We do have some time cards if they end up being necessary as well. So, but all right. Thank you. Please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dosland, and I represent the Minnesota Community Education Association. First of all, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee for their work this session, especially with your focus on early learning programs and the focus on our youngest learners. So thank you for all your hard work. I'd also just first like to thank you for the inclusion of the School Readiness Plus slots, making that funding permanent. We appreciate your support for that. And I'd like to just talk about a couple of provisions in the bill that we have concerns about. First of all, Section 1 of House File 2610, which prohibits a full pre-kindergarten program from dismissing a child from a pre-kindergarten program. Community MCA surveyed some school districts to learn what's currently happening in school-based pre-kindergarten programs. From what we've learned, districts go to great lengths to prevent this from happening. Inhibiting access to early education programs by removing a student at the preschool level would be really counterproductive to our mission to prepare students for kindergarten. And instead, districts do a lot of extensive work with families to put measures in place to support children. To do this well, especially children that might be having some challenges in their pre-K program, to do this well, there needs to be numerous supports, whether it's special education, behavioral specialists, mental health consultation, other programs that might be more appropriate, as well as programs to support the parents. And I just want to emphasize that MCA believes that all preschool programs should go to great lengths to support the needs of children, and dismissal should be exceedingly rare in any setting. However, there are instances where, at least temporarily, the preschool classroom is not the right place for the child because of their needs or because of the conditions around safety they are creating for other children of the future. We believe some flexibility for programs is called for, and we hope that you would consider adding language to the bill. We have met with Representative Richardson and discussed our concerns and hope to continue working with you as well as Representative Richardson on that.
Thank you, Ms. Dosland. That's your 2 minutes. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I just want to add the license licensure requirements. We've been working with Education Minnesota and appreciate their flexibility.
Good. Thank you so much, Ms. Doslin. Next, we've got Ms. Ford, Sarah Ford, and then Caitlin Snyder will be up after Sarah Ford. And please identify yourself for the record, and then please begin.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Sarah Ford. I work with Education Minnesota as an education policy specialist. And I'm here today to support the provisions in the Early Childhood Education Bill that makes School Readiness Plus funding permanent and the requirement that pre-K teachers be licensed. The benefits of high-quality pre-K programs, according to research, are many. They include increases in cognitive development, increases in high school graduation rates, more stable employment rates, higher income, higher levels of home and car ownership, greater family involvement, a reduced need for special education services and education remediation, reduced rates of criminal involvement, social service use, substance abuse, reduced achievement and opportunity gaps. But those benefits are not identifiable with all pre-K programs and, in fact, are specific to only very high-quality programs. So what does high quality mean? That's the great question. The National Institute for Early Education Research lists appropriately trained teachers as one of the 10 benchmarks of high-quality pre-K programs. In 2013, researchers Jane Best and Courtney Cohen examined the peer-reviewed literature on what characteristics ensure high-quality pre-K. One of their conclusions is as follows. Pre-K professionals benefit from age-sensitive ECE-specific training. The teachers responsible for creating a stimulating environment, utilizing the tools and teaching methods proven to have the greatest impacts in determining the overall quality of interaction the child receives while in the classrooms. The instructor who knows how to implement best practices and identify when a child is struggling to meet age-appropriate developmental milestones will be able to adjust lesson plans accordingly and give each child the opportunity to make optimal progress. In fact, the National Institute of Medicine, the National Research Council, the Foundation for Childhood Development, the National Institute for Early Education Research all agreed that high levels of requirements for pre-K teachers are critical. All of these research and policy organizations agree that high levels of training are critical for any program that hopes to create large and persistent gains in academic achievement. The research is clear. Programs with highly trained teachers produce long-term academic gains. Programs that do not have highly trained teachers don't often do that. Because of this, it is our belief that pre-K teachers in Minnesota should be licensed. Thank you.
Thank you. And well landed on the two-minute mark. Well done. Caitlin Snyder, and then after that, we're going to have Claire Sanford. So she can be ready to go. And please, once you settle in, identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Caitlin Snyder, Minnesota Department of Education. I would like to thank the chair and the committee for the inclusion of the items from the governor's education budget and policy bill that are in front of the you and the DE amendment today. This includes maintaining funding for voluntary pre-K and school readiness plus, making sure that these programs are not unfunded moving forward. Inclusion of the Head Start background studies language that will make sure that tribal Head Starts and Head Start programs that do not receive CCAP funding can meet federal requirement. The inclusion of the Early Learning Scholarship Special Revenue Account, which will ensure that 1,000 more scholarships can be awarded to make sure that students are receiving high-quality early learning programs. The income waivers language for early learning scholarships, making sure that students in protective services, in foster care, or experiencing children are not required to provide income verification in order to receive early learning scholarships. One potential little concern is that there may be a fiscal cost for the legislative report that's outlined in Section 15. MDE staff is working with DHS staff, and I see how it's aligned with the work that we're doing with the preschool development grant to see how closely aligned this is already undergoing, so we should be able to report back shortly. Overall, we look forward to working with the committee as this bill moves forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm noticing that I think the folks had signed up by bill, and at least based on the number of testifiers who signed up in advance, I think we won't have too many. So I think what we'll do is that we'll continue having folks. We have a couple people who had testified on both or signed up for both, and so I think what we'll do is continue on with the focus on the on House File 2610, the Education Finance Division report, and work it that way. And then we have some folks who'd signed up to discuss points in the HHS Finance Division report, and so we'll continue with that. So Ms. Sanford, come on up. And so you can feel free, if you wish, to focus on the points on House File 2610. Eric Armakonke is up after that. So please identify yourself for the record and feel free to begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Claire Sanford from the Minnesota Child Care Association.
District
early education programs. It's unclear if this would apply only to teachers who are direct employees in the district or if it would apply to teachers employed by community-based mixed delivery partners. Both NDE and Governor Walz keep saying they want to strengthen mixed delivery in public early childhood programs, but this proposal could work against that intent. First of all, teaching licenses are a credential for the public K-12 system, not one for community-based early childhood. As such, few licensed teachers work in community-based settings. Most community-based providers do not have to our licensed teachers in the K-12 system, a full 96% are white. This in no way matches the diversity of our low-income children, which are the very population these public early ed programs seek to serve. We're proud of the diversity and experience of our teachers in early education, and we understand that they need to be there is research correlating BAs and AAs to child outcomes, and that is where the early childhood field is moving. That's why the National Academies of Sciences Transforming the Early Childhood Workforce Report issued recommendations to move towards BAs, not teaching licenses.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Armakaki, come on up, and after that would be Mayla Slislow. Mr. Armakaki, you can settle in, and then once you're ready, identify yourself for the record, and please begin.
Thank you. I'm here to speak swiftly to the education report and planning our support towards Section 15, the legislative report on early care and education coordination. With respect to the consultation that goes into this report, we strongly support the inclusion of families that access these programs, advocates, and including perspectives from different racial, cultural, ethnic, or geographic groups. However, we also want to raise some concerns about other areas from Section 2, specifically the broader areas of or other early education programs online 1.20. We understand the intent, and appreciate the opportunity to work with stakeholders to get a little bit of language more aligned with, I think, what would be the most productive way to address everyone's concerns. But overall, we are concerned with the broadness and vagueness of language and how that could adversely impact teachers of color and American Indian teachers in early care settings, as well as in a favor programming that centers the cultural and linguistic needs of children. For example, right now there are partnerships with culturally relevant child care centers that bring a language and culturally specific approach to their curriculum, and this broad language could adversely impact those types of partnerships. So we appreciate the opportunity to testify on this petition report, and we look forward to more conversations on this section too. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Armakaki. I'm May Lisloso, and come on up, and then Denise Mayotte will be after that. And so identify yourself for the record, if you can, and then please proceed.
Yes, hello, Chair Fisher. I'm from the Division. My name is May Lisloso, and I speak on behalf of the Voices and Voices for Children Coalition. And I'm here to express our concerns with Section 2 of the Division Report around licensing requirements. The current early childhood teacher population is 5 to 12% teachers of color, in comparison to only 4% teachers of color in the K-12 education system. Through Parent Aware, NACI, and other quality measures, the field of early childhood has been ensuring that there are multiple measures of accountability and transparency for families to understand the outcomes for their children. There are no studies that currently show that the quality of pre-K programs is determined by having a licensed teacher in the classroom. As it is currently written in the Division Report, smaller pre-K programs that partner with districts and charters may be at risk if their teachers are required to get licensed. Ideally, we would like to see greater emphasis on incentives that include any financial supports or sustainable pathways for early childhood teachers, many of whom are coming from low-income backgrounds, communities of color, and greater Minnesota, to pursue both the required bachelor's degree as well as going through the licensure process. Unnecessary licensure requirements can contribute to the overall teacher shortage that currently exists.
It will potentially shut down pre-K businesses and limit parents' choice to where they send their children to pre-K. We are in conversation with stakeholders, and we want to see more pathways for folks to get into the workforce versus unsupported requirements. We're working with stakeholders on this issue, and we are hoping to see some compromise. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Denise Mayotte, come on up, and after that will be Marie Huey. And then once you settle in, identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Denise Mayotte. I'm the executive director of the Sheltering Arms Foundation, and I'm part of the Many Minds Coalition's executive committee. The Many Minds Coalition, as many of you know, is a broad coalition of over 100 statewide organizations, including foundations, nonprofits, and advocacy groups, all united in prioritizing Minnesota's youngest children as the most important investment for a stronger Minnesota. Our agenda is supported by parents, early childhood care and education leaders, teachers, business leaders, and community members united in making access to high-quality care and education possible for every child in Minnesota. First, I'll touch on the relevant provisions of House File 2610. Many Minds supports the expansion of scholarships for children from birth to age 3. Thank you for that. The elimination of the Pathway 2 scholarship cap, the increase for early learning scholarships, and the special revenue fund. We oppose, however, the elimination of new scholarships for four-year-olds that are not in priority categories. Restricting scholarship access to four-year-olds that otherwise meet the income eligibility requirement has the potential to set children back in terms of kindergarten readiness, especially considering the current shortage of early childhood and pre-kindergarten programs across Minnesota. And just briefly on House File 1801, the coalition supports the elimination of the Child Care Assistance Program waitlist for basic sliding fee, the market rate survey adjustment, the home visiting language, and the grants to improve the quality and increase the availability of early childhood education programs. As the legislative session continues, we hope this committee will prioritize any additional money for early learning scholarships. Scholarships provide high-quality early childhood care to children with the highest need. Thank you for the opportunity to share our perspective today, and I really want to thank all of you for your work in supporting Minnesota's youngest children. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Mayotte, you managed to fit in on both bills. So well, but also on both bills. That was very efficient, so we thank you. All of us keep moving. So Ms. Huey's next, and then Sarah Strong-Belisle will be up after that. So please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good evening, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Marie Huey, and I am the Public Policy and Advocacy Coordinator at Think Small. Our mission is to advance quality care and education of children in their crucial early years, and I'm here to offer support for House File 2610, which we believe is a good tool to help prepare children for kindergarten. Think Small commits to policies and practices that empower a just, inclusive, and equitable care and education system for young children. We know that Minnesota's achievement gaps begin as early as 18 months and are rooted in opportunity gaps. By investing in children early, we can help close these gaps. With this in mind, we are very much in support of scholarships going to the youngest children in our state to help them access quality care and education as early as possible. And we are also in support of the $6 million to add into the scholarship allocation annually. So thank you. However, we do have concerns about the annual cap of the individual scholarship amount remaining at $7,500. Because infant and toddler care is even more expensive on average than preschool care, we believe the current cap would hinder a successful rollout. Our experience as scholarship administrators tells us that families who are most in need and with younger children are put in the position of having to be pulled out of care during the middle of the year because their scholarship has run out. And this is not helping to prepare them for kindergarten, and the disruption is not good for kids. So please consider making sure that that cap is addressed. Thank you very much for your time and for your efforts to support our youngest children, and we look forward to continuing to work with you.
Thank you, Ms. Huey. Come on up, Ms. Strong-Belisle, and then it'll be Tame Zhang after that. And once you settle in, identify yourself for the record, please, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sarah Strong-Belisle, and I'm here representing Close Gaps by Five. First, I want to thank all of you for your work on behalf of Minnesota's youngest learners. As longtime supporters of early learning scholarships, Close Gaps by Five was encouraged by House File 1, and we were hopeful about the proposed level of investment fused with the concept of ensuring an efficient education system. We appreciate that at least a small amount of investment was made in scholarships in the bill, and look forward to working with you to try to grow that number as session progresses. At this level of investment in early education, it would take three decades to close Minnesota's early learning opportunity gaps, and Minnesota's kids need all of us to have a much greater sense of urgency. While we strongly support reaching infants and toddlers with early education opportunities, the need is so great that we believe prioritizing state funding would make the most positive impact.
For example, first ensuring that young children ages 0 to 5 in the most high-risk groups are being served, then proceeding to children below 100% of poverty, and so on. We have long called for improvements to the usability of Pathway 2 scholarships for families and do not support the provision in this bill lifting that cap without the needed policy changes, like ensuring that Pathway 2 scholarships are as portable as Pathway 1 scholarships. We have done extensive work this session with Representative Breyer and with you, Mr. Chair, on a package of initiatives to better coordinate the state's existing investments. We'd like to thank you for including the CCAP and scholarship coordination report in the bill, and we really appreciate the willingness to continue to look for resources in order to make progress on the other provisions from that package. So thank you very much for your efforts, and we look forward to working with you all as this progresses.
Thank you, Ms. Strong-Belial. I think that Ms. Zhang is not here, and so Ikram Kaliso. Oh, she is. Oh, yeah, no, Ikram. Yeah, Ikram's coming up, yeah. Come on up, and then after that will be Jim Bartholomew. After that, so please identify yourself for the record and begin.
So my name is Ikram Kaliso, and I'm from the city of St. Paul. Good evening, Chair and committee members. As I already mentioned, my name is Ikram. On behalf of the city, I'm here to thank the committee for including the St. Paul College Savings Account pilot program in the Education Finance Division report. This is an early childhood initiative aimed at connecting children and families to early childhood resources, and studies have shown that at birth it improves social and emotional development as well as helps increase educational attainment and graduation for our youngest in our community. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, I also want to thank the committee for your advice and feedback on our bill. We're working closely with committee members to ensure that the lessons and best practices learned from the pilot program will be used in creating our statewide program. So, thanks for your investment in our youth. Yeah.
Thank you for your testimony. And so Mr. Bartholomew, come on up. And after that, we'll have Beth Yoakum after Mr. Bartholomew. Once you settle in, please identify yourself for the record and then begin.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Bartholomew with Minnesota Business Partnership. Thank you for your work this session and the opportunity to comment on the amended version of House File 2610. I'd like to just briefly highlight three items. First, we have strong concerns with the changes to current law being made on lines 8.14 through 8.16. This lifts the cap on Pathway 2 scholarships, which has the impact of reducing the number of scholarships that would otherwise go directly to families. Second, we thank you for the increase in funding for scholarships, but we'd encourage you to not adopt the change on line 7.1. We think there is value in fully funding existing commitments to 3- and 4-year-old children and high-risk children ages birth to 2 before shifting to all children birth to 4. And finally, the coordination report in Section 15 will help shape future reforms to better serve families. We thank you for that and for all your work, and look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, and members throughout the rest of the session.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bartholomew. And so we've got Ms. Yoakum, and after that will be Jim Nicolai.
Good evening.
Please begin.
Chair Pinto and committee members. First of all, thank you all for your work on House File 2610. We appreciate it very much. Your support of early childhood means a lot to us. I'm Beth Yoakum, and I manage early learning programs for Nopa Hadley Schools. That includes BCFE as well as preschool. I'm here tonight asking you to consider a revision to Section 7 of the House File 2610, which is lowering the eligibility for scholarships to birth to age 3. Under current law, the recipient must be 3 or 4, and I'm here to ask you to consider including 4-year-olds in the Early Learning Scholarship Age Eligibility Requirement. While I fully support including scholarships for children ages 0 to 3, I am concerned about excluding 4-year-olds from eligibility, as it could negatively impact low-income families that we serve in public school preschool programs who greatly benefit from being in the program. We serve, in our program at Okehennepin, we serve close to 3 times more 4-year-olds than 3-year-olds. It's about a 3/4 to 1/4 split. This means that there are fewer children to qualify for scholarships to attend preschool if only 3-year-olds are eligible. With less funding from scholarships, I cannot serve as many preschool children from low-income families. Most of our families that are low-income come to us to enroll their child to preschool at age 4, not at age 3, for various reasons. Many are highly mobile, perhaps moving into the district at the time that they have a 4-year-old, or often they come to us knowing their child will go to kindergarten in a year and would benefit from preschool to be K-ready. Clearly, families need our preschool program for their 4-year-olds. So, while supporting scholarships for younger children, too, it is important that 4-year-olds remain as part of the scholarship eligibility mix. I heard from colleagues from other school districts regarding this age-eligibility change who have expressed similar concerns about preschool access for low-income families with four-year-olds. So, to summarize, I'm asking you to consider revising the proposed age eligibility requirement for early learning scholarships to include four-year-olds. So the children from low-income families ages 0 to 4 have access to scholarships. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Yocum. Mr. Nicolai. And once you settle in, identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Nicolai. I'm with a group called Elders for Infants. I want to talk a little bit about 2610, the legislative report on coordination of care and education. It seems to me that the voluntary pre-K and public school preschool programs, as well as Head Start, should also be included in this effort to coordinate. Parents in middle intensive care are looking to patch together whatever works for their family and their budget. Secondly, I'll flip over to 1801. The CCAP rates remain at the 25th percentile, which will continue to mean that parents will be looking for substandard programs or trying to pay premium over and above their already high copay. Programs with high quality standards and decent pay and benefits cannot sustain a business model at the 25th percentile and often go out of business. So we've lost a lot of good nonprofit child care programs, Children's Home Society, Pillsbury Neighborhood Services, and others that simply can't keep a high standard, and so they quit doing child care altogether. The change from 2 to 3 years for the market rate survey will mean that the market rate that we are working off of, the 25th percentile, the latest market rate, will be 2 or 3 years behind. So it continues to find a substandard system. How am I doing?
Pretty close, yeah. Actually, 15, but that's
sorry. Some small progress has been made in the infantile care, and we still have a tremendous deficit. We're still going to be turning out 3 and 4 year olds that have an achievement gap. It would be better to prevent gaps from opening rather than try to close them at 4.
Thank you, Mr. Nicolai. I think you were signed up on 1801 anyway, so we can see how that as well, so we can see how that goes. Is there anyone else who should testify on House File 2610? And I should note that we'll do House File 1801, and then at the end I'll ask if there's anyone who wants to testify on either, because we had talked about getting testimony on both. But just in case there's someone who wants to testify on 2610 right now, since we've had a bunch on that, and seeing none, then we'll move on to House File 1801. And the first person signed up for that is Claire Sanford. And after that will be Eric Armakaki. And so, Ms. Sanford, come on up. Oh. No problem. And so again, once you settle in, identify yourself for the tape and then or the recording, and then please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Claire Sanford. I have a question before I start. I had contacted Adrian because I'm testifying in two capacities, one for Kids Can't Wait and one for NCCA, so I'm not sure if I should do both now or just do one and come back up later or what.
We could maybe give you three minutes to do where you do one half and the other one half. I mean, whatever works. But I guess I'd say make the distinction between the two. If you really feel like you need more than 2 minutes on each one, then let us know that. So make whatever distinction you need to, and if you feel like you need more than 2 minutes to separate each of those out, we can do it however you want.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Well, in that case, I will be Claire Sanford on behalf of the Kids Can't Wait Coalition,
okay,
a group of 17 organizations supporting reform and investment in CCAS. First, I'd like to note on all the program integrity issues, we want all CCAP funds to go to CCAP-eligible families and children to get consistent, stable care and healthy development and parents to be able to work and go to school. Program integrity is necessary to ensure that this happens, and Kids Can't Wait is supportive of this session's focus on ways to prevent and detect misuse of CCAP dollars in a program so critical to tens of thousands of Minnesota children and families. While not all of our CCAP priorities are included in this report, I'm here to thank you for some significant steps forward. Coming into conformity with federal law governing CCAP has reached a crisis point. Minnesota's been out of compliance since 2014 and is one of the few remaining states to be so linked to the party. Our waivers are expiring and patience at the federal level is wearing thin.
We applaud the fact that this report would bring Minnesota into compliance with the CCAP-related provisions of federal law. Homeless families will access CCAP sooner. Families moving from county to county will no longer face a loss of CCAP. And families will be able to move off of MFIT more quickly without worrying about losing child care support. We're also proud that the report includes a provision to extend CCAP to homeless families for a period of 3 months while employment or school is obtained. Any parent with young children knows that a trip to the grocery store is difficult, much less job interviews or sorting out financial and legal issues related to obtaining housing. Those require a parent's focused attention and can be impossible without this 3 months of support to stabilize the family. We also appreciate the investment in families on the waiting list in CCAP, helping them move into our economy more quickly. We are disappointed that this report does not include an automatic updating of provider rates after 2018, which means Minnesota could easily fall out of federal compliance within a couple of years. Overall, Kids Can't Wait is pleased to see this report steps to federal conformity and help for low-income families and children to achieve better economic and developmental outcomes through CCAP.
Thank you. And I guess, Ms. Sanford, I will. I think I understand that those two associations may have some different focuses when it comes to this bill. As long as you're up here, why don't we have you testify on behalf of the Minnesota Child Care Association, and we'll just give you the 2 minutes to do that.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. We'll just keep this party going. I'm still Claire Sanford, but now I'm with the Minnesota Child Care Association. And we greatly, as the Minnesota Child Care Association, appreciate the focus on program integrity in CCAP. Misuse of CCAP funds hurts us all. And we must not lose sight of the critical role CCAP plays, particularly for infants and toddlers. So we need to balance shoring up program integrity and dealing with a few bad apples, but continue to invest in tandem. We are very pleased that this report brings us into compliance with CCAP provisions and federal law, as I just said, for Kids Can't Wait. It doesn't bring us into compliance with all provisions. There are some licensing provisions that aren't included, but those are in Chair Liebling's committee, and we hope they'll be considered. While the 25th percentile is already noted as far from where we need to be, which is at the 75th or above, the 25th percentile at the most recent market survey is a solid first step already passed by both bodies last year. However, same concern. We could fall out of federal compliance very quickly because this only ties a rate update to the 2018 survey, and federal law requires that it is updated every 3 years to the most recent market survey. It's a critical piece of federal conformity, and this is like getting our heads just above water only to slowly start sinking again. In terms of licensing reform in this bill, there are items included that would help reduce some frustration for providers, and we are happy with those. We're also big fans of the investment in First Children's Finance. We think they do great work and are glad to see that work supported to help child care infrastructure across the state. We're also very excited to see a state investment in Retain, the program that helps provide wage supplements to professionals in the early childhood field. And I think I can stop. That was the education bill number.
I'd
like to reach out and read provision and the scholarship.
There you go. That's good. You actually had a few seconds to say it, to fit that in, so you're golden. All right. Reach out and read the scholarships. We got it. Thank you, Ms. Sanford. So next we have Eric McConkey, and after that will be Jerry Cutts. So once you settle in, identify yourself for the record, please, and then proceed.
Thank you for a second opportunity again, Mr. Chair. Again, Eric McConkey, Children's Defense Fund Policy and State Affairs Director. So here to express our support for the decision report in general, but specifically, it's great to see the inclusion of the family-friendly federal conformity provisions. This includes eliminating the portability pool waitlist, easing transition cliffs for families accessing MFIP, and expediting applications and temporarily waiving work and education requirements for families experiencing homelessness. And we also support the increased funding that's going to address the basic sliding fee wait list. These appropriations are critical to get families to work and ensure that our children are being cared for properly. With respect to provider reimbursement rates, it's an improvement to see an update to the 2018 market rates survey, especially since we're going off the 2011 survey right now. However, we hope this provision gets revisited at a later time to increase up to the 75th percentile and to be using the newest market rate survey going into the future. We also appreciate the steps that this division report takes in acknowledging that CCAP toddlers should go to CCAP families, and we support efforts to make this happen through measures that best center the needs of children and families. Finally, we appreciate the comprehensive set of policies that this division report goes to improving early childhood development. At CDF, we like to say we always support a penny flower field approach, so it's great to see investments in home visiting as well as simple but productive measures like an appropriation for food shelf programs to be able to purchase diapers. So in general, thank you for this division report and then all the work this committee has done to help these reports out today. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your testimony. Mr. Kutz, you're up next, and after that will be Ann Krisnick. And so as you settle in, identify yourself for the record, please, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jerry Kutz, CEO of First Children's Finance. I'm here this evening to express gratitude to this committee and to Chair Pinto for recognizing the incredible opportunity we have to make real progress with our providers in state, center and home base, urban and rural. Since 1991, almost 30 years ago, First Children's Finance has been an ally of the State Department of Human Service and numerous philanthropic and community partners to support the business of child care. We do that with trained staff on the ground in every corner of the state, with proprietary analytics that help providers maximize their capacity and earning potential while improving quality for the children they serve, and very importantly, with financial resources available to providers. The revolving loan fund that's included in Representative Pinto's bill will allow us to increase the number of providers we can support. With a combination of low interest and forgivable loans, outright grants, and business technical assistance, we'll identify the best path for each provider in the community that they serve to ensure their success in the long run. We're grateful for the $1 million included in this bill, and we'll put every penny to good use and reuse.
Thank you, Mr. Kutz. So, Ms. Krisnick, you're on up, and then Kathy Filbert will be after you. And please proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kathy Krisnick. I'm the Executive Director of the Joint Privileges Legislative Coalition, and I'm here to speak in support of provisions and the CCAP portion of the division report. We're very appreciative of the federal conformity of the family-friendly provisions, especially those that address families experiencing homelessness and those that address the current challenges for families on AMFIF and for those that choose to move or part of their path toward economic stability and run it out of portability pool. We're grateful for using the 2018 market survey in determining provider rates, but we also recognize that 25%, even if it's at the 2018 level, is not going to be sufficient to solve our current child care crisis in Minnesota. We look forward to working with the committee in the future to address that. We also are very appreciative of the funding to address the number of families on the waiting list. And just this morning before I came, 2106 was the number, and that's 2106 too many, and really appreciate those steps toward eliminating the waiting list completely. Finally, I just want to share comments of other testifiers that we, like all of you, and all CCAP dollars should go to all to CCAP families. We support her for that.
Thank you very much, Ms. Krisnick. Ms. Filbert is up next. It'll be Jim Nicolai up after that. And so as you settle in, identify yourself for the record, please, and then please begin with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Filbert. I'm from St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health. I'm here today representing the Local Public Health Association and the Minnesota Coalition for Targeted Home Visiting. We want to thank the committee for its support on voluntary home visiting programs. They are an effective strategy to give families the best start in positioning them for long-term sustainability. Additionally, we want to thank you for adding language that allows for both evidence-based and evidence-informed programs. While all the home visiting programs are voluntary, the additional flexibility will help communities such as ours meet the diverse needs of families. This is especially important to counties such as St. Paul Ramsey County, as one of the most diverse counties in the state of Minnesota. We serve families from all racial and ethnic backgrounds. Our families speak a combined of 30-plus languages, reflecting our community as a whole. Our home visiting programs have served our community for over 100 years through both evidence-informed and evidence-based home visiting. This continuum has been a highly effective strategy to serve populations as they change. Finally, we want to thank you for providing some expansion funding for home visiting programs. We know the needs outweigh our investment and applaud the legislature for supporting families as they ask for help. Thank you for your time this evening.
And thank you for your testimony. Mr. Nicolai, you are up next.
All right.
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot about that. You did both bills. Good point. Any other member of the public who wishes to provide testimony on either bill, either House File 1801 or 2610? And not seeing any, then in that case, we are done. And then we will be back on Thursday morning discussion of the two bills and then eventually voting. And so thank you so much to all. And with that, we are adjourned.